The following program is brought to you by its producer and host, Total Theater, and does not necessarily reflect the views or thoughts of this radio station, AM 1240 WGBB Freeport, but it reflects my views. I'm Dave. You'll find out a little more about me almost immediately. Here we go!
Tropical hot dog night! Two flamingos in a fruit fight! Every color of day, twirling around at night.
Well, there goes the neighborhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By, an hour of talk radio, comedy, and music on this Thursday, October 28th, 2004. We've had 99 bottles of show on the air. 99 bottles of show. By which I mean that this program, Dave's Gone By, is exactly one show away. This one, from its centennial. Our first episode was October 6th, 2002. Our 100th episode will air, God willing, November 4th, 2004. And in between, we've got this little doohickey. Not that I'm denigrating it. Not that you should switch off your radio saying, well, what do I need this crappy 99th show for when the big 100 is just a week away? And I understand that impetus. I do. I'm trying to make the 100th show special. A lot of highlights, cool moments from Dave's Gone By of days gone by, but it doesn't mean this episode will suck. Au contraire, the suck factor of this episode is being kept to an absolute minimum in anticipation of the big anniversary. After all, maybe some people tuned in tonight for the 100th show. They got confused, didn't realize it's still a week away. So here they are, primed and ready for this incredible birthday show. And they're hearing me say, no, wait, it's only number 99. Nothing special, just the usual dreck. I mean, how are they supposed to feel? People pulled over on the highway sobbing with disappointment. Radio listeners under tremendous amounts of daily stress, walking that razor's edge between sanity and the madhouse, making that daily choice between coming home and thawing out a TV dinner or traipsing into the shopping mall with a reloadable M16. Perhaps the deciding factor this particular night, the difference between a plateful of Stouffer cutlets, mashed potatoes, and peas, and a dozen dead teenagers sprawled and bleeding in the Green Acres Gap, the one small hope that keeps the American psycho moving toward the microwave and away from the burlap bag in the garage, his belief that Dave's Gone By is going to be pretty good tonight. The world may be against him. His colleagues at Burger King snigger behind his back. Women avoid him in bars, but he comes home Thursday nights, flips on WGBB AM 1240, listens to a little of the fishing show, because, you know, that's his kind of people, and then 7 o'clock, the one shining light of his existence, Dave's Gone By. An hour of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music, a respite from the horrors of this world and the brooding mysteries of the afterlife. Do I tell this man, oh, well, this one's really lame tonight. I don't even know why you bothered tuning in. Why don't you just wait until next week when I actually have something good on? Do I risk a body count, a death penalty, and potentially an accessory charge on my record by shirking my responsibility to make each and every Dave's Gone By the best it can be? Well, do I? Of course not. I promise you, every person out there, but especially Mr. Dangerous Psychopath listening, you have my word that tonight's show will be as entertaining, as interesting, as engaging and diverting as I can possibly make it. So step away from the archery rack and the gasoline-soaked rags and the oatmeal jars filled with ricin. Have a seat in a comfy chair. Pour a tall glass of buttermilk. Switch off the voices in your head and listen to this darn good episode of Dave's Gone By, hosted by yours truly, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, journalist, and humorist, and sponsored by the printing, copying, binding, and corporate gift experts, Hewlett Minuteman Press, and by the fabulous flatbreaded tasty toastiness of Quiznos of Hewlett. More on both those establishments a little later. We will also have Inside Broadway, our weekly look at New York theater, and this week, the one-year anniversary of Wicked and the sad new historical drama Comfort Women. I also have a rant planned about the, well, I guess you can guess what it's about, since we know it's coming up in a couple of days. Plus a guest. Yet another special guest for my special listeners, both psychopathic and stable. She is the very talented and very busy Joyce Castle. Joyce is a mezzo-soprano who has appeared in several roles at both New York City Opera and the Met, and not just the old chestnuts, but groundbreaking new stuff, too, as well as a couple of pieces by Leonard Bernstein. She worked with him on several occasions and has a few anecdotes to share. And she's also done her share of non-traditional postmodern theater with people like Anne Bogart and Richard Foreman. Now, I hope it doesn't sound arcane and academic. We're going to keep it all on a fun level for everybody to learn a little about opera and theater. And Joyce Castle is doing both simultaneously right now. She's appearing in Dialogue of the Carmelites at City Opera and in the new musical Belle Epoque at Off-Broadway's Mitzi Newhouse Theater. I don't know how she found the time for an interview, but she did, and I'm delighted to have Joyce Castle as my guest tonight in the neighborhood. I told you this episode wouldn't stink. It will, however, be rated DGB-13. The Dave's gone by equivalent of PG-13, as all our shows are. Nothing obscene or prone to set off an orange alert at the FCC. However, if we don't say something vaguely provocative or triple entendre naughty, we're just not doing our job as creative radio people. So stay with us for the next hour as we send up 99 Dave balloons on Dave's Gone By. We'll get poppin' with Inside Broadway right after this.
Quiznos of Ulit is tasty and yummy. Delicious flatbreads that ease down your tummy. Sandwiches piled up on artisan bread. Pass by that Subway's, eat Quiznos instead. Turkey and roast beef and tuna and ham. Quiznos of Ulit's the place where they am. Ken is the bald guy who serves all the meals. If you're a student, there's all kinds of deals. When I'm hungry, when I'm thirsty, when I'm really spaced. To Quiznos on Broadway in Hewlett I go to toastily feed my face. Quiznos of Hewlett, toasty tasty.
Inside Broadway, brought to you by Total Theater's Performing Arts Insider, your everything theater guide. It's rare these days when you get three really worthy musicals on Broadway in a season. Some years, you're lucky to get one. Remember that time Sunset Boulevard was the only show on the ballot for the Best Musical Tony? But last year was a horse race. Last year, you had the zany and bawdy and sometimes brilliant and incredibly likable Avenue Q. You had the more serious and well-crafted and well-regarded Caroline or Change. And you had the big, splashy, crowd-pleasing, and undeniably exciting Wicked. Well, where are these three shows now? Caroline or Change couldn't grab a big enough mainstream audience to have a hit run, so it closed after a few weeks. But the show looks to have a very strong life in regional theater in the years to come. In fact, it will be running at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles from now till Christmas. Avenue Q, in something of an upset, won the Best Musical Tony last year. In fact, it won Best Book and Score, too. And after a slow build-up, it's been doing boffo business at the box office, sold out nearly every week. In fact, since the Tonys, it's been an even hotter ticket than the producers. As for touring plans, well, that would have been difficult to begin with, since the show requires actors who can be funny and sing while manipulating hand puppets. Perhaps realizing the casting limitations of such a requirement, the producers of Avenue Q decided not to do a national tour. Instead, they're bringing the show to Las Vegas, where Steve Wynn is building a 1,200-seat theater specifically for that musical. Avenue Q's producers say that keeping the show in Vegas will spare them the high costs involved in touring and allow them to gross nearly double per week what they now make on Broadway. But what of Wicked, the show that had appeared to be the favorite going into last year's Tonys? Well, Wicked is doing very well, thank you. Like Avenue Q, it's one of the hottest tickets in town, sold out pretty much every week. It's one of the highest grossing shows on Broadway, too. If you watched last year's Tonys, you also remember the other big horse race. who would win Best Actress in a Musical. Would it be Donna Murphy of Wonderful Town, or Tonya Pinkins and Caroline or Change, or the two Wicked girls, Kristen Chenoweth and Idina Menzel, both of whom were spectacularly good in the show, by the way. Now, the judges went with Menzel, who plays the lonely, outcast green witch, Elphaba. She eventually finds her cause and risks her newfound popularity to see it through. And Menzel is still in Wicked, which is reason enough to see the show. Chenoweth is off to other things. I think she's getting another sitcom. And taking her place as the quote-unquote good witch is Jennifer Laura Thompson, a Tony nominee herself for the fabulous Urinetown. If you haven't seen Wicked, I do recommend it strongly. I found it a very savvy mix of both big-time special effects and Broadway razzle-dazzle, laying on to a very powerful story that has both satirical elements and a touching friendship at its core. It also has a couple of good songs by Stephen Schwartz, the guy who also gave us The Baker's Wife and The Magic Show. And when Idina Menzel jumps on her flying broom at the end of the first act and sings about defying gravity, I defy anyone visiting Oz not to be enchanted. So happy birthday, Wicked, which opened at the Gershwin Theater a year ago, October 30th. Will it keep following the yellow brick road to Broadway fortune? The best way to find out is by subscribing to Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Broadway, off-Broadway, cabaret, opera, dance, it's all here in Performing Arts Insider. Before you spend $100 on a single theater ticket, use Performing Arts Insider to find out more about the show. Before you audition for a new musical, before you recommend that comedy to the board members of your local playhouse, get all the facts and figures in Performing Arts Insider. 516-295-1511 is the number for subscription information, or email paipress@aol.com. paipress@aol.com. Single issues are only $10 for Dave's Gone By listeners, or you can get 10% off your subscription if you mention the show. 516-295-1511, or visit TotalTheater.com to find out why you need this theater magazine, Performing Arts Insider. We continue with Inside Broadway and a couple of off-Broadway shows opening this week. Very serious one coming out of Urban Stages on West 30th Street, Comfort Women. Now, this is based on a little-known atrocity coming out of the eastern side of World War II. It seems the Japanese realized that during a long and bitter war, their troops would want some relaxation and recreation. So, the government sanctioned the kidnapping of young Asian women, some as young as 12, to become prostitutes for the troops. The vast majority of the girls were Korean, though there were also Filipinos and Chinese and Indonesians. Families would marry off their daughters to anybody in order to spare them being forcibly taken by the Japanese government. And of course, just like their pals the Nazis, when the war turned, the Japs began destroying all the records of their handiwork and murdering as many comfort women as they could. Others committed suicide, and the ones who survived coped with isolation and poverty. After all, just as with rape, even though there shouldn't be, there's a sense of shame involved for the victims. And society has never been decent in dealing with violence when it has a sexual component. Now, I mean, look at Kobe Bryant or Scott Peterson, or especially then. Korean women finally started speaking out about this abomination in the early 90s, which is when Korean-born playwright and poet Chung-Mi Kim became interested in the subject. She eventually wrote the one-act play Hanako about the tragedy. That has now been expanded into the full-length drama Comfort Women, opening tonight at Urban Stages. And finally, on Inside Broadway, tonight is the first preview of Belle Époque, a non-traditional music, movement, theater, and dance piece at Lincoln Center's Mitzi Newhouse Theater. Celebrated choreographer Martha Clark stages the show, which features mezzo-soprano Joyce Castle. Now, if you want to know more about her, stay tuned. And if you want to know more about theater in general, get yourself Performing Arts Insider and listen every week to Dave's Gone By for more news and reviews inside Broadway. We've just been inside Broadway with Total Theater and Performing Arts Insider.
Hey, can I get these things copied?
Yeah, dude. 15 cents a page, plus ink, labor, parts.
Parts? Yeah, I need that of heavy stock, bound and laminated.
Whoa, we don't do that.
All right, just copies then.
No problem, I'll take a week or two.
What? Give me my copies back.
Just a minute, man.
That's it. Minuteman. I should have gone to Helix Minuteman Press. They do everything. Copying, shipping, gifts, 1315 Broadway in Helix.
Ain't that next to Fortunoff?
Out of my way, hippie. I'm off to Helix Minuteman Press.
Copy on, dude.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. Time for a segment called Dave's Got Guests. And I do have a wonderful guest with me talking to me about opera and theater. I don't really get to talk about opera very much on this program. I think most of you might remember when I had Stefan Zucker, the opera fanatic.
Oh, sure.
Yes, and you're. Oh, I can hear my guest Joyce Castle already knows who that is, so maybe we'll talk a little about him. Very interesting fellow and really nice guy, actually. But yes, my guest is Joyce Castle, who is a mezzo-soprano, and she will explain what that is. She will also explain the difference, hopefully, between operatic theater and opera, because she is doing both at the moment. She's simultaneously appearing in two different things, one at Lincoln Center, one at City Opera, and I'm going to let Joyce Castle take it away and tell us all about it. Joyce, hey.
Thanks. Hi, Dave. Oh, well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Actually, both of the shows are at Lincoln Center, so I only have to go across the plaza to get to the other theater. I'm at Lincoln Center in New York, at the New York State Theater, and at New York City Opera, doing Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites. That's the opera, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Lincoln Center Theater, at the smaller theater downstairs, you know, the Mitzi
Newhouse.
Yeah. I'm doing this new piece of Martha Clark's called Belle Époque, which is the life and times of, showing the life and times of Toulouse-Lautrec.
And what do you play in that? Because you're not Toulouse-Lautrec in that, obviously. Well, you never know with Martha Clark, but yeah.
Oh, dear, that's good. That's well said. But, it's going to be wonderful. It's like a dream of Toulouse-Lautrec. We have Mark Povinelli playing the role of Lautrec. And then you see, in Martha Clark's piece called Belle Époque, all these characters you have seen in his posters.
Oh, cool.
So you see the dancers, and you see, you will, the audience will recognize from the way they look on stage and their costumes and so forth, I think they will anyway, the dancer who was called Valentin, and there was another dancer called Chocolat. And I am doing the cabaret singer. I'm doing cabaret songs of the period, especially the songs that were sung by Yvette Guilbert. And there again, a character that he loved very much. He liked her looks. She was a quirky-looking thing, skinny, red hair. Well, I guess they all had red hair piled on top of her head, and long black gloves, and he painted her many times. We even have recordings of Yvette Guilbert, so that's been pretty interesting because I can listen to what she sounds like and then try to sort of, you know, give the impression.
Was she a mezzo?
Oh, well, you know, when I'm singing in Belle Époque, I'm just a singer, you know, like a cabaret singer. I wear many hats in my career. I've done a lot of opera, yes, but I've also done a lot of so-called crossover music theater pieces, a lot of Bernstein, for instance, a lot of Kurt Weill. And I've done a lot of French cabaret songs. I've done I have a little program that I've done several places of songs of the period, because they're just catchy little verse songs. They're fun for the audience. They're a little saucy, of course, because they were in the cabarets. But
and you do them in French, or do you translate and then sing?
Well, yeah, we're doing most of them in a translation of Michael Feingold, terrific translator. And so there will be a little bit in French, But most of it will be in English with a few little words of French in there to give the character of the piece.
Now, you've done quite a bit, when you say of crossover into theater, you've worked with some of the more avant-garde leading lights of theater, including in your resume, people like Richard Foreman and Bogart and Joanne Acolytis. Is there a particular reason that you gravitated to that kind of work rather than, say, more mainstream commercial Broadway theater, or just sort of happened that way?
Those, I don't know. I was cast.
Okay.
I was cast in the case of Anne Bogart. It was downtown with Lynn Austin, Lynn Austin's music theater group, and so that was a very bizarre version of Cinderella that Anne Bogart directed. Richard Foreman directed a sort of an opera, although wow, it was really music theater, called Where's Dick, which we did at Playwrights Horizon, and then he directed it at Houston Grand Opera.
Wow, okay.
So it just comes about. Eric Simonson from Steppenwolf last year directed Handmaid's Tale, which is an opera, which I did with Minnesota Opera. Tazewell Thompson right now at City Opera, he's very well known, perhaps more well known in theater. I think I would say I'm lucky to be cast with them.
Well, Thompson's directing Carmelites, right?
Right.
At City Opera.
Yes.
And you play the prioress in that. And if people aren't familiar with Dialogue of the Carmelites, and I admit I'm not, so
yes.
Thinking it was a little pricey of what that show is.
Dialogue of the Carmelites is the story based on a true story. During the French Revolution, there was an order of Carmelite nuns north of Paris who took the vow of martyrdom for the peace of the country, and they were turned out of their orders. They were not allowed to say mass and so forth. They were not allowed to wear their garments, and they went to the guillotine instead of. As martyrs, 16, absolutely true story. And 10 days later, the revolution was over.
Wow.
So in a way, some people think that it worked, but you see that in this opera. It's oh my goodness, it is quite a dramatic story. I don't go to the guillotine. I play the role of the old prioress in the first act, and she is very, very ill, and the end of the first act is a 20-minute unbelievable scene of dying.
You get a 20-minute death scene? Oh, that's fabulous.
And,
actors,
and
my
it
gosh.
Is. Some people say it's the finest, finest scene written in 20th century opera. It's a jewel of a piece of writing, if you see what I mean.
And was it necessary to find a show that where you were done by the first act so you could get to Belle Epoque, or they're not jiving? Well, you know, it's kind of...
I love that question. That's great.
Oops, let me die a little quicker because they need me across
Thank
the screen.
Thank you for saying that. I must say it helped in the rehearsal period.
Well, then there was that, the last time people have really talked about this was with, of all people, Cynthia Nixon, before she was famous. One of her first big moments was when she was appearing in Hurley Burley.
Oh, I see.
And she was doing another role at the same time, three blocks away on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, she would, like, scoot. I don't know how she did it, but she managed it somehow. Because I think she only showed up in Hurley Burley for, like, 10 minutes here and 5 minutes there.
Oh,
and she'd run, you know, and change at the other theater.
Well, that's in both shows in theater. In this case, this is one show in a theater, Belle Epoque, and opera, of course, can't do every night. We only have 6 performances, and so I'm just missing some rehearsal tonight. I will miss preview of Belle Epoque The second night, an understudy will sing Belle Époque while I do the last performance of Dialogues of the Carmelites.
Okay, so,
and then I'll take over for the rest of the show, rest of the run of Belle Époque.
Now, you have, but you're appearing at City Opera now, but you have done quite a few roles at the Met. And
also, yes.
Yeah, and I'm kind of wondering about the first time that you appeared there, because that sort of, it's like La Scala. I mean, there's just something about the Met.
Yes, there is.
So was any memories of that very first show you were doing there, or that first night you stepped out on the Metropolitan Opera stage?
Yes, there's a memory of City Opera, too.
Okay.
But at the Met, I was in the new production then, it was 1986, of the New Ring. Well, it isn't new anymore, but that was the New Ring.
It was when Newland Wagner wrote it, yeah.
And I was the Waltraut in Valkyra.
Mm-hmm.
And that was extremely exciting, of course, to be at the Met with James Levine conducting. And I remember standing backstage before I ran in on my first entrance, the sound of the unbelievable orchestra at the Met. You know, that is just a jam, and that was very thrilling. I also remember the first rehearsal I had at the Met. I remember going up on the set and turning back out and looking out at the house. I said, "Whoa, okay." Same thing at City Opera. When you get the job and you're on that stage for the first time. Same thing, Paris Opera. First time I was there, these fine concert halls and Seattle Opera and so many at the Kennedy Center. The first time I appeared there, I'm not blasé. I don't know. That's good. I hope I don't lose that, because it's very exciting for me. Theater is very exciting. Singing's.
Let me ask you, you had mentioned before that your scene in Dialogue of the Carmelites, that big, you know, long-lasting, wonderful death scene, is considered one of the best scenes in modern contemporary opera. And yet there still seems to be a schism between sort of the Verdi and the Rossini and the Puccini, and then everything else that came after them. I mean, they try to, and you get maybe Porgy and Bessel, maybe Sweeney Todd. But do you think there's ever going to be that kind of bridge where people will accept? And I'm not sure I do, because I don't like a lot of the modern music that's coming through. But what do you think, can it happen where these modern things become as much a part of the canon as La Bohème or La Traviata or Die Walküre, you know?
Isn't that a question? Because we don't know what's going to happen in 50 years or 100 years, and wouldn't it be interesting if these operas that we're doing right now are the mainstream then too? I can say I've been associated with so many 20th century works. I like to do them. They're very often they're very dramatic. I like to do modern pieces. I'm not afraid of hard music. So I have been attached with a lot of them. I can say that they go over, very often they go over very, very well. This Handmaid's Tale, you know the movie and the book, but wow, this was a ride. It was a great success, I'll say, in Minneapolis. I've done Dominic Argento operas. The Casanova that I did at City Opera was very well, you know, was a big success. Vanessa, of course, I've done. Lulu, well, Lulu's in the Met. I've done Susanna at Carlisle Floyd. We did Susanna at the Met, and that's in the...
So there's a niche. They're sort of making their own little niche into the canon.
Yes, I'm going to do Jake Hagee's End of the Affair next fall in Seattle. He's, of course, written Dead Man Walking, which has gotten a lot of performances. And then, of course, I've done a lot of Benjamin Britten. Those are surely they will be mainstays in 50, 75 years. I was so fortunate to be able to do Gloriana at Central City Opera. That's the role of Elizabeth I of England.
Oh, cool. Since I brought up Stefan Zucker before, one of the questions that he would ask on his long-running opera show when it was on WKCR, he had literally a poll taken of, like, the greatest tenor of the century.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And people were writing, oh, yeah, did you ever appear on Stefan's show?
I didn't. I just know about him. I've heard something of his, and I've seen, of course, many of his articles.
Right, yeah, I mean, he's amazing.
I'm sure.
And to talk to him is a treat.
He knows everything, doesn't he, about opera.
Pretty much, yeah, but it's also the way he does it. He makes it a lot of fun in a very odd and interesting way. And that was the joy of his show.
Great.
And one of the things that kept the interest was every week you get entries of why they thought Carlo Bergonzi or Jussi Björling or Pavarotti was the greatest tenor of the century, and then he'd read why and explain, and it was really cool.
Yeah.
So I have to ask you, do you have a greatest tenor and or soprano and or mezzo-soprano of, well, not this century, but of the last one?
Mm. Well, Björling is oh so high for me. I just, I love my recordings of him.
And Corelli was pretty big on the program. He was discovery, yeah.
Fantastic, yes, and I was lucky enough to hear him in a few things with Birgit.
Wow.
Wonderful. I like, I like Pavarotti, too, and Domingo. I can't choose.
Do you have any specific reasons that would be more technically singer-y than your average person listening? Because, you know, Pavarotti is extremely popular, of course.
Pavarotti, you know what, I teach some also at the University of Kansas. I have an artist-in-residence position, and I'm always suggesting if they want to know anything about Italian diction, go listen to Luciano, because you can just write it down, and I love it when you can it's very important for me, for my audiences to understand me. So important, I think, is diction. So I think he's wonderful. It's just a wonderful sound. It's a wonderful sound. And Domingo, the range that man has sung, this is quite a musician intellect. And
of course.
He seems to be able to do it all, doesn't he?
And what about the ladies?
Oh, well, mezzos, of course, that's my voice. I love Krista Ludwig and Janet Baker were very high on my list. Giulietta Simeonato for a great Italian coloratura. Not that I'm a coloratura singer, but it's inspiring. If you get a singer, no matter what voice they are, that's inspiring for you, that's great. I listen to, want to talk sopranos? Okay, I listen to Kirsten Flagstad.
Okay.
And wow, that's a voice that just, magnificent voice that can just soar over the orchestra. I like to listen to Joan Sutherland. I heard her on stage, too.
Wow.
For her unbelievable trills. Coloratura, high notes. Not my voice, but doesn't matter. You know, it's so inspiring. And I like to, you know, I'm a singer, but I like to go and listen to singers, too.
Of course.
I just like to color the voice, too, so that I can do other roles. That's why I was able to do a lot of Mrs. Lovett's, and I call myself a fake belter.
You brought up another name that we've heard of, more than heard of, Leonard Bernstein.
Oh, boy, I have so many memories of Lenny.
Oh, wow.
I really do. I was at Tanglewood first. That was my first job. I was at a music theater project up there doing Ligeti and Kleine Mahogany. Gunther Schuller was up there. It was a big time. Lenny was coming to my shows, and he was very appreciative of my work, would talk to me about it. Then, much later, I started doing Candides at City Opera. So So I did The Old Lady and The Old Lady and the New World Record of Candide. And so he knew me from that. I had sung on the Bernstein London Symphony Orchestra big bash that they did for him, sang Old Lady for him. I remember that very well because he came backstage and he saw me across the green room, and I'm a very tall lady, and Lenny was not the tallest man, right?
Okay.
And he said, "Joyce, Joyce." And then he said, "No, wait, I need this." He pulled a chair over and stood on it to congratulate me. That was a memory.
He was a showman.
I was chosen to sing arias and barcaroles, and we rehearsed with him, and he played the piano and Michael Tilson Thomas in Lenny's apartment in the Dakota for a week.
Oh, wow.
That was quite an experience.
And any other cute memories of stuff he did, or moments where you learned something from him?
I'll tell you, he smoked all the way through those rehearsals, and no one told him to put that cigarette out.
I assume as a singer you do not smoke.
No. I must have I've never been in the presence of someone with more energy. It is just like it was a ball of fire energy in the room. It was very exciting.
Let me ask you, I mentioned the cigarette before, but also we think of especially opera singers, not so much theater people, even though they have to stay in shape and take classes and movement, but we really think of opera people having very constricted sort of lives that are, they're constantly protecting their voices and all that. Do you have these regimens and the you know, hours and hours of practice every day? And you have to watch? No.
No. I try to stay as I've sung for a very long time, of course, by now.
Mm-hmm.
I have to take care of myself. I have to stay healthy, try to do exercise, I have to have sleep. Just to sing well, I need my sleep. But I don't want to get too regimented about not eating such and such and not doing this. I take care of myself, I'll say it that way.
And
too scared of it, I think, might be counterproductive.
Hmm.
I think to be more at ease with your life, more, I certainly don't mean I'm going to go out and drink a lot and certainly don't smoke, you see what I, but...
But I mean, moderation, but you're not, like, walking around with a muffler around your neck and drinking tea with honey, you know, once every hour kind of thing.
No, no. Actually, I drank Diet Coke caffeine-free backstage. It's pitiful. It's true.
I just got a free plug. That's really neat. Let me give a free plug also to the two shows that you are in, both, as you said, at Lincoln Center. You're in Dialogue of the Carmelites at New York City Opera, and that's only six performances, because, you know, as you said, operas are not every single day.
Yeah.
But many more performances of Belle Époque, which is a collaboration between Martha Clark and Charles L. Mee doing the text, and that is at the Mitzi Newhouse Theater, the little theater in the Lincoln Center Theater. Your career is continuing, and you're singing, and how long... I mean, you know, there's a certain point when opera people or even theater people have to sort of think about stopping. And then others, no, they just go ahead or they do recitals and stuff. Mm-hmm. What would you say is you know, your point on that level?
I think when the health goes, don't you?
Okay,
cool. I think it's about health. It's also about health of the voice. I've sung over 30 years. I've kept, I've certainly been... working on my voice all that time to try to keep it not to push it, you see, so that it's healthy now. It has remained healthy. I'm thankful for that.
Well, yes.
And you know, I listen to myself on tape recorders. When I hear that I don't like it, I'll probably stop. I hope so, sure. But I'm a mezzo. So that's the lower woman's voice, of course. And we are chosen, we are cast to do the roles of mothers and grandmothers and the older people on the stage. or witches, or men, or...
or Valkyries, you're right.
Sorceresses.
Right.
You see, I am not... No one has ever thought of me as the sweet young thing, ingenue.
That's okay. People never thought of me as that either. It's
okay.
I've learned to live with that, you know.
Well, I'm very lucky that way. I can go on as long as... as long as, you know, as long as I can.
Oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm the radio.
That's right, Joni. I turn you on all week long for a bunch of shows on WGBB, like Wednesday nights at 11 for psychic astrologer Joyce Keller, hosting radio's longest-running psychic advice show. She knew I'd say that. Thursday nights at 6, an hour before Dave's gone by, it's WGBB Tonight with Larry Davidson. And then, right after my show, Smooth Jazz, the Instrumental Invasion with Mike Shamari at 8. Friday nights at 6, Bonnie D. Graham has advice about being single and singular on Long Island's dating. And things get wilder on the weekends with the Saturday Night Rock Block, starting at 7:30 with the Mr. Redman Music Show, up-and-coming Long Island rock bands, and a weekly countdown, followed by Mikey and Jimmy. It's a madhouse. It's a zoo. It's Mikey and Jimmy, Saturday nights at 9. And then, on Sundays at 7, Joe Salzone offers conservative politics with a sense of humor and an open mind on your world.
If you're driving into town with the dark cloud above you,
dial in AM 1240 WGBB for Joyce Keller Wednesday nights at 11, Larry Davidson Thursdays at 6, yours truly at 7, Mike Shamari Thursdays at 8, Bonnie D. Graham Fridays at 6, The Rock Block Saturdays from 7:30 to 10, and Joe Salzone Sundays at 7.
Call me at the station, the lights are open.
Welcome back to this last portion of Dave's Gone By on this October 28th, program number 99, which I am proud to say has been 99% suckage-free. I'd say 100%, but that would be bragging, and besides, nothing in this world is 100% everything, and who knows, maybe the last 10 seconds of this episode will stink. I mean, I could break wind. No, wait, that would be really cool. Or I could blow a shrill whistle or play one of those car alarms. Wee-hoo, wee-hoo. No, that would suck. I could insult you. That would ruin a perfectly good show, but I don't want the ill will carrying over into next week. So maybe I'll just let the end of the program be normal and go for that 100%. I am 100% grateful to my special guest, Joyce Castle. Remember that she is in two different productions right now. See her in both. Dialogue of the Carmelites at New York City Opera in Lincoln Center, and the Toulouse-Lautrec-inspired Belle Époque, also at Lincoln Center in the Mitzi Newhouse Theater. You can get more information on both at lincolncenter.org. So again, big thanks to her for making the Daverhood a Divahood, and to Dan Dutcher of Cone Davis Associates for setting everything up. Thank you also to my splendid sponsors, Total Theater, publishers of Performing Arts Insider, Quiznos for tasty toasty sandwiches on yummy artisan bread, visit the one on Broadway in Hewlett, and mention Dave's Gone By for 10% off your meal. And then cross the street to Hewlett Minuteman Press for all your copying and printing and binding and engraving and tooth whitening needs. Also, 10% off if you mention Dave's Gone By. And speaking of mentioning the show, some other programs on this radio station do just that. Joyce Keller, radio psychic on Life and Love, Wednesday nights at 11. Bonnie D. Graham with her own romantic recommendations, Fridays at 6. The Mr. Redman Music Show, Saturdays, 7:30, followed by the Mikey and Jimmy Show, 9 to 10, for wacky zoo-style comedy. Then Sundays at 7, it's Your World with Joe Salzone. He's a pro-Bush conservative, but he really tries to be fair to all sides. And Joe is doing a big special Tuesday, Election Day, November 2nd, and he will be here all night long with election returns. And I'll be here too, part of Joe's team after midnight, helping to analyze, concretize, and humorize the results. That's all Tuesday night into early Wednesday till 6 a.m. We'll all be exhausted by then, half of us jumping for joy, the other half crying in our Pepsis, and I wouldn't discount a fist fight, or a knife fight, or perhaps a torrid gay orgy. I mean, we're straight, but hey, Politics does make strange bedfellows, and besides, we've got to do something to top last year's election fiasco. Probably with an erection fiasco, but let's not go there. Let's go instead to Thursday night, 6 o'clock, for WGBB Tonight with Larry Davidson, and then at 7 o'clock, me, of course, and then at 8, Mike Shimeri with the Instrumental Invasion, and the music continues at 9 with Filler Up. It's an eclectic mishmash of rock, folk, country, jazz, usually with some theme tying it together, like tonight. You'll hear everything from Charlie Daniels to Cleo Lane. It's a really cool show with an intelligent, amusing, and fabulous host, me. So if you like Dave's Gone By, give Filler Up a try Thursday nights at 9. And just a couple more reminders, including these from my beloved wife, Joyce. She wants to remind women that October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So check for lumps, get those mammograms if you're older, and if you're not sure how to do a proper self-breast exam, I'm generally at the station on Thursday afternoons, and would be more than happy to demonstrate and palpate and evaluate and master the techniques for maintaining breast health. Please don't thank me, that's just the kind of guy I am. And just the kind of radio organization this is, WGBB, the station that serves your communities. But seriously, folks, Joyce also says that although everybody's busy concentrating on November 2nd, don't forget that November 1st, a new law goes into effect. All New Yorkers, private dwellings, and institutions must have carbon monoxide detectors installed. Last week on Filler Up, I played a birthday tribute to Weird Al Yankovic, and let's not forget, both his parents died in April from carbon monoxide poisoning. They lit a fire in the fireplace, forgot to open the flue, fell asleep, and they never woke up. So please, folks, I'm usually not this serious, but starting November 1st, it's the law. Get yourself a carbon monoxide detector, install it in the best place to save your life, and test it every few months, just as you would your smoke detector, your burglar alarm, and your door-to-door Jehovah's Witness spotter. And since we're playing Spot the Loony, please do not forget to go out and vote. Go to your polls and show that you believe in democracy and that your political voice counts. At least, that's what I'm supposed to tell you. But the cynic in me says, well, no, it doesn't really count. I mean, we're in New York, which is just one big pile of Democrats, and that's the way the delegates will go, and 10,000 swing votes wouldn't make a difference, let alone one. But vote anyway. And I'm supposed to be objective and say it doesn't matter whom you vote for. That's between you and your conscience. Just make sure that you do vote. But the pragmatist in me says, hey, if you're a Republican, stay home. And if you're undecided, vote Kerry. Don't go with some write-in or some obscure third party. And for God's sakes, don't make the major mistake that I made 4 years ago, when I assumed my vote wouldn't count because New York would be so overwhelmingly anti-Bush. In a way, that was correct. That's what happened. I mean, before the Supreme Court coronated George the First. But, or actually, it's George the Second, isn't he? But because the election was so close, and so disputed, and so unbelievably ridiculous, there was actually talk of discarding the delegate counts and reverting to one person, one vote. Now, which means that my protest nod for Ralph Nader would have been a disastrous waste. Even now, when they say that Gore won the popular vote, I realize with chagrin that my vote wasn't even part of that statistic. Now, I didn't vote for Ralph Nader because I liked him. I voted for him because he somehow convinced me that there was little difference between Al Gore and George Bush. As if. So that taught me a lesson I won't forget. If you have two evils to choose from, you vote for the lesser of two evils. You don't throw your vote away to the guy snickering on the sidelines. Because if the greater of two evils wins, that's 4 full years of being unable to say, well, don't blame me, I voted for the other guy. Not if you voted for the wrong other guy. And I have explained many times on this program, as well as on Joe Salzone's show, why George W. Bush is the eviler, the way eviler, of the two evils on the ballot. Kerry may be a waffler and a self-aggrandizer and a wannabe Kennedy, and he may indeed be the devil we don't know. But folks, look at the devil we do know. the one who was in power 8 months before 9/11 happened. George Bush wants to blame 9/11 on Clinton not going after bin Laden? Why didn't he go after bin Laden when he had the chance? Bush had already completed a sixth of his term when those four hijacked airplanes started hitting their targets. And he was reading a children's book about goats when they smashed into Wall Street. And he kept reading that book about goats until he was finished. Well, he's persistent, I'll give him that. And he flew the bin Laden family to safety when nobody else in America was flying anywhere. And he presided over 3 years of recession that is just starting to turn around, sort of. His jobless numbers have improved a little, probably because people just stopped looking. Gas and oil prices have soared to record heights, and this despite, or because of, his own ties to big oil and his vice president's former job with big oil. The minimum wage remains $5.15 an hour. Can you live on that? Can anyone? You could be living on the street eating pigeon droppings for lunch and still not get by on $200 a week before taxes. Not if you wanted health care, which has zoomed to astronomical heights. Not if you're paying into Social Security, which may be gone by the time we retire. Now, the president vows to do something about these crises during his next term. But why did he do nothing in his first term? He did pledge billions of dollars to fight AIDS worldwide, a pledge he later reneged on. And of all the woes and worries facing Americans, from war to terrorism to inflation to pollution, the disaster George W. Bush seems most afraid of is gay marriage. To paraphrase FDR, the only thing we have to fear is queers themselves. Two people declaring their love for each other and wanting a binding, meaningful commitment somehow rocks the foundation of our country more than poverty, unemployment, malnutrition, and racial injustice. Oh, sure, our president has other agendas he cares about, like stopping abortion and stem cell research. He doesn't care if the parents are drunken, abusive, inadequate care providers who dread having a baby so long as the baby comes out. He doesn't mind if kids are born as deformed mongoloids so long as they're born. And remember, the Supreme Court justices have been hanging on and hanging on, but they're not all going to make another 4 years. And when the next one goes, you know the president's going to find a Scalia Jr. to roll back as much of the Constitution as he can. And speaking of the Constitution and its First Amendment, how about the overstepping of the Patriot Act? Or Colin Powell's deformed mongoloid son, now running the FCC, who has simultaneously allowed monolithic corporations like Clear Channel to take over commercial radio and right-wing buttheads to turn the FCC into a mill of censorship and greed. During this crossroads in media history, where was Chairman Michael Powell? Getting Opie and Anthony fired, pestering Howard Stern, that's where he was. But let's get back to the big man. The fella in charge, at least putatively, and what could be his Waterloo, Iraq. I mean, for me, 9/11 was enough to send this jackass packing. The fact that we were unprepared for an attack by a dozen Mohammeds with box cutters says something about a president who's supposedly tough on national security, don't you think? But hey, when he went into Afghanistan to go after Al-Qaeda, we were with him. We figured these animals were hiding in the Afghan hills, and he had our support to go terminate terrorists with extreme prejudice. But then, a year later, Bush starts drawing a dotted line between 9/11 and Baghdad, saying that there are weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein won't remove, and that's why we're going in. Which was a lie. Which was proved a lie. And even if Hussein did have nukes, did have Walmart-sized factories manufacturing sarin, well, okay, bomb the factories. Target the weapons. Don't go in all alone and take over the country with no plans to get out. And every time the allegedly liberal media or the Democrats had the guts to ask about exit strategies, the Bush administration was vague or said that questioning the war was equivalent to not supporting the troops. Well, now we're in, and we've lost twice as many American troops after we'd supposedly won the war, then when we fought it. And Ashcroft and Powell and Rumsfeld all said, Gee, we didn't realize it would be this difficult. It didn't occur to us that we have less trouble fighting the war than securing the peace. And I say, you didn't realize? You didn't realize because you didn't listen. And will George Bush instate a military draft if he gets in again? He vows no. And even if we trust that for once he's not lying, if you wrap it all up, look at the last 4 years, how we've felt, what we've been through, what we've worried about, compared to the 8 years under Clinton, or even the 4 years under George's dad, who was a crappy president himself, but at least the workforce of Lower Manhattan wasn't turned into maggot food. Are you better off now than 4 years ago? The stock market isn't, prices aren't, healthcare isn't, more and more people are without coverage, the poor aren't, more folks are drowning under the poverty line, education isn't, millions of childs are being left behind. Psychologically, as New Yorkers, we still live under a cloud of repression and fear that I imagine hasn't been felt since the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis. The environment? Bush walked away from a global warming conference and supports anything that will keep this country running on good, greasy oil. Internationally, entire continents now hate the United States and believe our president is a schmuck, and we're bigger schmucks for putting him in office. So in conclusion, my fellow Americans, when you go to the polls on Tuesday, November 2nd, vote Kerry. You don't have to like him. You don't have to trust him. You don't have to believe him. You just have to get George W. Bush out of the mess he's made. Pull that lever down and vote. And then come home, flip the lever on your radio to WGBB all night for election results. And be sure to keep your radio dial at AM 1240 WGBB all the way through Thursday, November 4th, when Dave's Gone By returns with our 100th episode. Highlights and lowlights and new material and hopefully a new commander-in-chief. 7 p.m. next Thursday. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Vote early and often. And gone by. Thank you.